broken the law and have been sentenced to work on the moon. When their sentences have been served out, they are returned to their homes and reinstated in society. Just as you allow convicted prisoners to return once they have served their sentences, then they're not exiled to the moon for the rest of their lives. You've been listening to anti-Soviet propaganda. I understand that there are American capitalists here who spread such slanders. I first heard such stories when I was in school, Lucita countered. In a convent. Moloch's smile looked brittle. The church still tries to stir up trouble. No, dear lady, we do not exile people to the moon for life. And the lunar mines are not a modern version of the old Siberian salt mines, which were another capitalist myth, by the way. The prisoners on the moon live comfortably and work with highly automated equipment. There is not a pick or a shovel in the whole complex, believe me. I am glad to hear it. The party officially ended at 9 o'clock, although most of the guests had already left by then for their dinners. Moloch and the other Russians were the last to leave. He kissed her hand again and promised to call on her before the week was out. Lucita smiled graciously and said she would await his call. Her father walked Moloch to his waiting limousine. The rain had finally stopped. He chatted amiably with the Russian for several minutes, then watched as the long black car pulled away from their front door. Hernandez walked slowly up the steps. A servant shut the heavy oak door behind him. "Well," he asked his daughter, "what did you think of him?" "He is very charming," Lucita answered. Heading for the dining room, Hernandez said, "More than charming, Lucita. Powerful, important, very important. He will make an ideal husband for you." "No, father," she replied, "he will make an ideal husband for you." He stopped and looked down at her. "Merely because it would be advantageous to me is no reason to reject the prospect of marrying him." "Father," she asked, "will it be necessary for me to love him? Or is that unimportant to your plans?" He threw up his hands. "Love! Women always talk of love. You expect me to marry him, to sleep with him and bear his children. Shouldn't love be considered?" "You will love him in time." "I will not marry a man I do not love," she said. He gave a disgusted snort. "But you have loved several men that you have not married." "What has that to do with it?" "Everything. I didn't raise my daughter to be a whore." It was as if he had slapped her face. Lucita staggered back, feeling her cheeks burn. She had no words. Her voice caught in her throat. "When I think of how your sainted mother must be shamed by your behavior..." "My sainted mother?" Lucita found her voice. "How do you think she would feel about your escapades?" "My, I know about your women. I've known for years. Have I ever reproached you for your behavior?" She felt tears stinging her eyes. "It is not your place to reproach your father," Hernandez said icily. "In any case, a man's standard of conduct is different from a woman's." "How convenient," Lucita spat. "How self-serving." Her father's voice turned iron hard. "I will not put up with your abominable behavior any longer. You will marry this Russian. It is already arranged. You will marry him with dignity and prevent our family's fine name from being dragged in the mud." "Never!" Lucita shouted, and she ran off toward the hallway stairs that led to her room. Slamming the door shut, she threw herself on her bed, but she did not cry. There was no time for that. She was thinking, furiously racking her brain for a way to thwart her father's plans for her. For the first time, she realized how deadly serious he was. It was not merely marrying her off for his own political advantage. He had learned about her adventures, and was determined to put a stop to them before scandal could threaten him. He was a powerful man, and it would be almost impossible to get away from him, but I must, Lucita told herself, I must escape. Somehow I must get away from Caracas and live my own life. But how? Who would help me? In all of Caracas, who would lift a finger in opposition to my father? She thought of Dan Randolph. The Yankee had been bold with her, but he seemed kind as well. "He will help me, if I ask him to," Lucita thought. But a nagging memory tugged at her. The Yankee was rumored to be in love with the American Presidenta. The whispers in Caracas were that he had fled to Venezuela because he had been in love with the wife of his best friend. That friend had been President of the United States. He had died in office, and his wife had taken his place. the first woman to become president. Soon, the rumors claimed, she would call Dan Randolph to her side to rule what was left of the United States with her. But before she did, Lucita resolved, Dan Randolph would help her to escape from Caracas, from her father's domination, and from this powerful Russian who was so temptingly handsome. Chapter 8. But it's an official request, Pete Weston stressed the word. You can't ignore it, and you can't turn it down. Who says I can't? Dan snapped. He had been out at the launch center all morning, clambering up the spiderwork towers where the heavy boosters stood, striding through the control stations where intense teams of men and women directed the shuttles that were heading for the space station and those that were returning to Earth. Dan spent at least one day a week out at the center, which had been built on a man-made island in the Caribbean between La Guaira and Catia-la-Mar, just off the coast where the old commercial airport had been. Now he stood on the uppermost platform of the original launching pad's tower, the bright hot sun sizzling the steel deck and railings. The tower was used as a meteorological station now. No rocket had taken off from this pad since the new heavy lift boosters had entered the company's service. Dan had torn through the morning at double his usual hurried pace, driven by a seething inward restlessness that surprised him with its intensity. The little entourage that accompanied him on these inspection tours looked absolutely frazzled. Dan had been rattling off orders and demands faster than they could record them on their tape machines. Tell maintenance to upgrade the electrical service to the flight control center before somebody blows all the circuit breakers with their double-damned coffee brewers. Why can't purchasing find seals that won't leak oil all over my coveralls? Look at them. And I want that ant colony down at the bottom of Pad 5 exterminated. This is the last time I'm going to tell you. If I see another red ant chewing on the insulation down there, I'm going to stake out whoever's responsible and let the ant chew on him. Can't anybody build a structure that doesn't leak? We shouldn't be getting rainwater through the roof of the assembly shed, for God's sake. When is MacReady going to spray these handrails with plastic? For Christ's sakes, we can build heat shields for space shuttles, but I still burn my hand every time I touch the railing up here. Pete Weston squinted through the dazzling morning sunshine at his boss. Nobody says you can't, he answered, but I'm telling you that you shouldn't. It wouldn't be smart to turn him down. Dan felt the sun burning into his neck and shoulders. After yesterday's interminable rain, it felt good. He stood spraddle-legged on the open steel platform, dressed in plain white coveralls and a baseball cap, fists on hips, his face set in a quizzical, puzzled expression. He felt something driving hard inside his guts, but he had yet to figure out what it was and why. You tell that handsome young commissar to go take a flying leap. Weston sighed deeply. He was a lawyer, a freckle-faced, balding, soft-spoken corporation lawyer who seldom left the air-conditioned quiet of Astro's offices in Caracas to come out to the field. Perspiration beaded his forehead and upper lip. His summer weight suit was visibly wilting and wrinkling in the humidity and heat, even though the sea breeze wafted his tie over his shoulder now and again. The five others with Dan, three men and two women, stood off to one side of the high platform, back where the anemometer and other weather instruments hummed away. They were in coveralls and caps, but their boss's furious pace this morning had soaked them with perspiration, too. Dark pools of sweat stained their white uniforms. Dan, please, calm down and listen to me, Weston urged. You pay me to give you legal advice. At least listen to what I have to say with an open mind. Dan scowled at him. The request came through the Ministry of Technology from the Russian embassy, as formal and official as can be. The new director of the Soviet space program would like to visit Astro Manufacturing Corporation's launch facilities while he's in Caracas. Would it be convenient for him to come out here this afternoon after lunch? No. Why not? Because we're busy, Dan snapped. We don't have time for VIP tours. This isn't Disney World, and besides, that double-damned bastard is only interested in seeing what we've got here. He's on a goddamn snooping mission. Weston sighed again, then asked patiently, Boss, don't you think the Russian surveillance satellites take pictures of this facility? Don't you think their people up in their space stations watch what we're doing? That doesn't mean I have to let them onto the grounds. I ought to remind you, Weston added, that legally this facility is on property owned by the government of Venezuela. Legally, Astro Manufacturing operates under Venezuelan license and is subject to Venezuelan